Clay's Black Velvet is very important. It is a late 19th century expression used for the prostitution of black women by white men. So that if you were Australian and you heard people talk about black velvet, you know the reference is to the black Australian woman who either is forced into prostitution economically or by the colonizers, by sort of imprisonment by prostitution. So that explains part of the title. The second is that these bags that you see are called dilly bags in Australia, D-I-L-L-Y. And they are the kind of bag that the lower class Australian black woman would be carrying, but they represent the kind of bag that these women would keep their whatever kind of cash they had or their possessions in. And these, according to Bowie, are vaginal forms embroidered on the outside of the bag. But the real sort of clincher here is that when she did research about these women, one of the documented facts is that they were often paid in opium. Opium dust, so that they would keep the opium dust in their dilly bags also. So it's, you know, a second kind of entrapment, right? Not just an economic entrapment, but an entrapment of these women by paying them in something that is completely addictive. So this, if you were Australian and you knew anything about the Aboriginal population, you would understand this piece, right? And this has always been my message for my entire professional life. You can't understand art unless you know the context it is made in. So let's go to this piece, Stud Gins. And Gins is G-I-N-S. Okay? So Stud Gins, and the year is 2003, related to black velvet. Stud Gins is a term used for very young prostitutes. So it's a slang expression about very young prostitutes. And here you see there are these woolen blankets hanging on the wall. Each blanket, it has writing on it. It's screen-printed lettering. These are gray and beige rectangular blankets. And this is immediately recognized again here, Australian, because these blankets were issued as part of a welfare package to Aboriginal people along with their rations for the week type thing. Remember I talked about the gathering in of the Aboriginal people in the welfare towns that they lived in? So these blankets are standard blankets that they would have, you know, that they were given by the government. And the rations were flour, tea, and sugar. So in different parts of this little installation, I'm assuming this is the flour part, there would be heaps of either flour, tea, or sugar. And again, you would understand it in the context of the welfare towns and Aboriginal people who were forcibly on welfare. The lettering on these screen prints, the original, defiled, women, discarded. So, in doing this piece, Foley has said that she's encapsulating an attitude by the colonists. She still calls her government, she doesn't really understand it as her government, she still calls Australian government a colonizing government because she's talking from the point of view of the Aborigine. So that's what this piece is all about. And I really didn't do this. So, you know what I mean? I'm going to do something very quickly so that you... That's not what I wanted. I'm just going to put this where it should be so that you can actually see it. So just let me... This is a piece called HHH.
already there.
Oh, and I need to move four, and I'll do it. Okay, so we're going to go to number five. So this piece is called HHH. Is the name of a song that the singer Bessie Smith made famous? Billie Holiday made famous. And how many of you know the song? Okay, so half the class played. And it the lyrics, which I didn't bring to class today, talk about strange fruit swinging from the trees. And it refers to the lynching period in our history when black bodies were lynched and were strung up on trees. And it's a very famous, infamous song. And I think that many people know the song as Billie Holiday sings it without knowing the reference what Strange Fruit is. So this is Strange Fruit, HHH. And this exhibition with these pieces was in London at the October Gallery, but it was sponsored by, very interesting to me, the Queensland Australian Government and the Indigenous Arts Marketing Committee of Australia. So I find it really interesting that you get this sort of anti-colonized Australian artist who then is also supported by the national government. It's very similar to what the United States did, especially during after World War II, during the height of the Cold War. The U.S. Information Agency sent many cultural groups abroad to perform. And the most famous of those cultural groups were jazz musicians, especially African-American jazz musicians, who were sent on world tours. And the whole idea here is not freedom. Listen to the kind of music they're playing and look at them. So it's that kind of situation that produces the patronage that this piece received. I think you can see immediately that this is a reference to KKK or Ku Klux Klan. And but HHH stands for, and I'll say this slowly, hedonistic honky haters. Right? Hedonistic honky haters. So the photographs that she published with this piece have a direct reference to photographs of the Ku Klux Klan. And many people do realize that photographs of the Ku Klux Klan are often very romanticized. Think about it. You see men on horseback, flames in the background, burning crosses, you know, murky air, and then this bright red. These are not photographs that say, this is awful, this is hatred, right? There's a real mixed message in the kind of photographs of Klan activity, or people dressed in white, you know, in front of these flames. They're very mystical in a sense, which is scary. So I think Foley is sort of riffing off of those kinds of photographs. And these photographs kind of reverse that's going on. Now, the other thing that's interesting about this photograph is the robes that the posers, as it were, are wearing, because some of you might see this, but this is African cloth, right? This is definitely different African cloth that they're wearing, and they're wearing very sumptuous, sort of batiky looking robes, very rich kind of photograph, but let's look at the close-ups. This one, you expect, perhaps. See the eyes? But look at the next one. Okay? So the question remains, you know, what is Foley saying in this? These photographs, how are they to be read? You know, in other words, is this a photograph about backlash, a piece about possible blacklash? Is it a piece that racism goes both ways often? And nobody owns racism. I think there is she commenting on, you know, the many colors of racism. And I think also in the fact that these people are dressed in the many colors, Some of them look Asian, some of them look Egyptian, right? You get sort of this idea of the many. So there's no answer, but it's the kind of piece that makes you think about all of these issues. So anyway, this is, you know, a younger artist, an urban artist, a artist who is the conditions in her country, but it's a very different art than the ones I talked about before. Yeah, good question.
What year was this one?
I think I said 06, did I? It was 06 in London. I think it was actually first done in 04, you know. And the last piece of hers I want to show you is, I'm going to do it this way. Mostly St. Vincent de Paul used clothing. You know, she bought the used clothing at St. Vincent de Paul, and she cut up the clothing, and that's what she made the letters out of. And the whole point here relates again to Australian history. Australia was colonized by the British, but it was set up first as a penal colony. Right? Australia was completely a penal colony. That's why the British needed it far away, right? Well, that served better than the original inhabitants of Australia, the Aborigines. So I want to end up the Australian lecture with Foley, because I think she, you know, we had to, I don't like not to talk about urban artists who are doing other kinds of art, even though compared to the acrylic dot paintings, she has no reputation at all, right? The acrylic dot paintings sell for, I just saw online, $100,000 for one online. So let's go to the next section. And that's page 20. Take a deep breath. My take a deep breath, draw a big line on work. And you also have to add to this page. You have to add and subtract to this page. So, this is, what did I want to start with? I want to start with watercolors, okay? By 1922, in this area, there was so much commercial interest commercial interests in the Southwest and in Native American art from the Southwest, that there were many quote-unquote preservation projects that were set up. So this is all, this goes into a package of Edward Curtis, the famous photographer, to live on reservations at this point, right? This was the end of the wars against American colonialism. So there's a parallel here that I'm trying to create with what I've just talked about in Australia. So you get the preservation projects that are set up and funded by either state or national government. So we have something called the preservation of tradition. And I always put tradition in quotation marks. So you have the preservation of traditional aesthetics straining against the forces of individual creativity and community development. So this is what happens whenever a governmental authority steps in and tries to preserve something, right? Preserving it means keeping it static. But we know that culture is not static, and it's always going to change, no matter what you do. So this is the tension of the early 20th century in the Southwest, when government agencies are pouring money into it. And what I'm talking about here is certain projects that happen because of this. So the prevailing attitude here is that the Indian is going to disappear. We have to respect their traditions, and we have to do something to preserve it. One of the forces, this is around Taos, New Mexico, which is still a cultural capital. Some of you might have heard of it, right? It's Lujan. Mabel Dodge Lujan, L-U-H-A-N. She arrived in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in 1917, and one of the first things she did is saw a Christmas dance outside at Santo Domingo Pueblo, right here. And she married somebody from Taos Pueblo, and she was very, very wealthy, and she traveled back to New York City. She got a group of her wealthy, sort of aristocratic cultural brokers on her side. She talked about the Indians. She talked about what she had seen, and she set up schools, art schools, and she started collecting art. So this is the atmosphere in the 1920, this is the atmosphere that we're talking about. So it's an example of sort of this idea of white man's burden. You might have heard that phrase, right? That, oh my goodness, look what we've done to the poor Indian. We better do something to preserve whatever is left, right? So you get all these projects. She made Taos into the Greenwich Village of New Mexico. And many, many, many artists from Europe and from the East Coast used to go and stay at her house. And it just became, you know, this is my case study. And I want you to understand the phrases cultural tourism, right? The nickname, or another word for it, is highbrow tourism. I'm probably the best representative of that in this room, at least, if not in the entire art department at San Francisco State. I've spent my life being a cultural tourist. That's what I do. I turn it into academic lectures and academic articles and books, etc. But I go almost anywhere to see stuff. I mean, I'm sort of a very good example of cultural tourism. And I come from sort of a genealogy in this country of people like me who politically want to understand a multicultural world and participate somehow in it. So my choice would be to participate as a professor in a university rather than a collector. I don't collect the art that I talk about at all. So there's a man named Edgar Hewitt, H-E-W-E-T-T. He became the director of the School H-E-W-E-T-T. Became the director of the School of American Research in Santa Fe, and then director of the Museum of New Mexico. Highbrow tourism and cultural preservation work, and that's what I was talking about right here. San Ildefonso Pueblo, okay? And what he did is he distributed watercolors and paper in about 1910, 1912 to the artists who were already working there. They were mostly working as ceramic artists. Some of them were doing traditional dances on the plaza and were costume makers, right? So he introduced this new thing like paper and watercolor. Does this sound like Australia also? So I'm really using this as a comparable. This is what happened at the missions in Central Australia that I talked about last time. And what happened is he gave birth to something called the Watercolor School, the Pueblo Watercolor School, by these activities. He commissioned artists to illustrate the cycle of life in San Ildefonso in order to preserve it, right? To illustrate it in order that it was preserved, it was remembered. And so he worked with many, many artists in San Ildefonso, and this created what scholars today call autoethnography. Autoethnography. Autoethnography means watercolor paintings that certain young artists did, and they did it as commissions that and knew that they were being commissioned to do it, they were paid to do it. So I want you to, I'm going to go quickly through them and then I'm going to go back because there's certain stylistic markers here that are very interesting. The first few are all by Fred Cavotti, okay? So here's one. Here's another. Just look up for a minute. Here's another. Here's another. The next one is Awa Tsire. And I think the next one is also Awa Tsire. Again, Awa Tsire. And this is the last one, Awa Tsire. What do these all have in common? Look at them carefully. They have no background. They have no atmosphere. You don't know really where you are. You have picked out certain special ingredients, right, that you are documenting, but there's no context to these. You're doing them on commission for white people who want to collect them, and they are autoethnographic documents. Do you all better understand? Do you see how vacant, right, these are? These are not payment of a style of dress for a ritual. So many people use another, it's called autoethnography, but another scholar introduced an idea that people use also to talk about this kind of situation, which is the contact zone, okay? I guess I'll type this up so you can, I'll pass it out like you could, I've done before, right? So you can add it to your study guide, right? But it's called the contact zone. And the young woman who, young anthropologist, she's a woman, who sort of invented this phrase is Mary Louise Pratt, P-R-A-T-T. She did it, I think the first book she did came out in the late 1980s when she was talking about this. So what we're looking at here is a contact zone where you take the indigenous tradition and then you take the commission from that indigenous tradition, which is the commission is usually by someone from the outside, and that contact zone now has produced a whole new style of art. with me? So we're talking about a phrase that I've used over and over in this class, especially the second part of this class, cultural hybridity. Cultures in fusion rather than cultures in collision. So here we have Fred Cabote, and just quite, you don't have to memorize this now, right? But I'm just showing you what I mean by this kind of autoethnographic, right? Hopi ceremonial dance. This is now what today? San Ildefonso Eagle Dancer. First of all, they're too clean. That's one thing I learned in Cuba, the difference between an altar that was used and an altar that was done on commission for a museum or whatever. The latter is always much cleaner than the former. Right? These are very clean watercolors. You can really tell that they're specifically intended for Hewitt, right, for putting in the museum. They were in two exhibitions. Mabel Dodge Lujan actually took these watercolors to New York City and put them on exhibit. And that's part of the reason I'm doing the American Indian stuff. When we get to the abstract expressionists on Tuesday, you'll see how all this affected them. The other story about the abstract expressionists. Awat Sire, corn dance at San Ildefonso. Awat Sire, clown emerging from a kiva. Do you all know what a kiva is? The sacred, no, okay. It's the sacred structure of Southwest religion. It's the physical architectural structure that is the sacred space of Pueblo and Anasazi religion. And it's and you enter it, see that ladder? You enter a kiva by going down a ladder and there's a hole. So this is clown emerging from the kiva. And this is, again, Awat Sire, San Ildefonso women. And listen to this. In commercial cloth back aprons filing in front of a row of shalako katsinas. I mean, even the documentation is totally academic on this. So these are the women, right? And they're talking about, I wish it were in color. I haven't found it in color yet. The fact that they're wearing some handmade clothing and some machine-made clothing. And this is a Zuni, a very, very famous Zuni ritual that you would never see as an outsider, right? It takes place in specially built architectural structures. You have to be specially invited in. But these are huge, like mannequins, and men climb underneath them and move around in them, and they're part of a December ritual. So you would never, the whole point is you would never see this stuff, right? Except that we're getting them documented. Do you have a question?
Well, do they adapt the 1920s hairstyle? Did they notice that the women had bobs?
No, this is about 1920 that this would have been done. Yeah.
So are they adapting the Western hairstyle too? Or is it that?
Sure looks like it. But that means they can't be Hopi, so who knows? You know, I mean, it's like I said, and that was this morning, I was explaining what Edward Curtis does, did his famous films of Indians, and all the films were sent to Washington, and everybody, I can't, it's interesting that you noticed that, and I didn't notice the hairstyle, so thank you. I just want to show you one or two more. These are a little later, this is 1947, but again, it's that, you know, it's in the 40s now, so you have, it's a little looser in terms of the construction of the figures. There's a little more information about the Pueblo, but it's part of this watercolor tradition of the Southwest. So these young artists were sent to government schools, and the government schools would deliberately try to downgrade indigenous traditions, and then there would be people like Mabel Dodge Lujan who would come in and try to change the art courses in the government schools, okay? So that's this idea of the contact zone. This is sort of interesting. If you've ever been to the Palace of Governors in Santa Fe, New Mexico, it still looks like this. It's still, you know, Indians setting up in the main square of Santa Fe, New Mexico. This is actually painted by Pablita Velarde in 1941, but it's a document, right? It's an ethnographic document. This was painted in 1930, and it's the new bride, the new Hopi bride. So I want you to feel comfortable with this idea of the contact zone. I want you to feel comfortable with the idea of autoethnography and, you know, and sort of the creation of a brand. So that's this. And now we'll go to Maria. There she is. They alphabetized this for me. I wanted it set up by course, but couldn't do it. Oh, probably it would help you to know that in 1935, they established something called the Indian Arts and Crafts Board, the United States government did, and it still is in existence. So this, the paintings I just showed you, were shown in New York City in 1930 and 1931 also. The next artist we're going to be looking at is a woman and her husband, Maria and Julian Martinez. And so, again, the whole idea is that sort of paralleling what we did with African art for the beginning of the course in Europe. And now I'm doing American Indian art, right, in the United States for this part of the course, at the fair. And what's so interesting to me is 1904 is just a few years after they were all, these, we know, some of you know them as the Sioux, but they're no longer called Sioux. They were all either killed or put on reservations. So here they are sort of on parade, show-offing, you know, at the St. Louis Fair. And then I found another, which I think is a very interesting. This is the St. Louis Exposition of Industrial Arts and Crafts of 1919. And here we have a really wonderful basket maker. She's from Carson City, Nevada. And it says here, who has woven blankets that have sold for $3,000 each. So you can imagine what this would go for today. But again, so beginning in the early 1900s, American Indians participated in these fairs, these expositions. They were commercially viable. And you know, then the Southwest watercolors would get gallery shows, et cetera, et cetera. And just another, I think, very interesting shot. This is Keene's Trading Post in Arizona. It's one of the oldest trading posts in the United States. This is a photograph from 1897. And look at the amount of indigenous art in this photograph that's for sale at this trading post. So this is not new stuff. This has been going on for a while. Okay, so we're back. Some maps so you just know where Rio Grande. Right, so just follow up the Rio Grande. And we're going to talk about that same pueblo, which is San Ildefonso. And I'm going to introduce to you Maria Martinez and her husband, Julian Martinez. This is the cover of American Indian magazine in 2005, when the Museum of the American Indian is being opened and stuck on the mall in Washington, D.C. So this is a retrospective exhibit of one of America's stellar ceramic artist who was Native American. The style of pottery here is a good shot too. It's very hard to photograph black on black pottery. Is an invented style that Maria and Julian worked on for years, and they became very, very famous for doing blackware, this kind of blackware that you're looking at. So here's Maria. Sort of later in her life, she lived from 1887 to 1980, and she lived in San Ildefonso. San We saw watercolors from San Alfonso, and now we're going to see ceramic artists. The first tourist pottery to sell in the United States, in the Southwest, was from San Alfonso in the 1880s. And by 1900, there were two different families in decorating. He was a watercolorist, he was a painter, and he was decorating the pots that the females in his family made. There were other husband and wife teams in San Alfonso. I'm going to teach you about Julian and Maria Martinez. So by 1915, pottery making became a profitable institution in San Alfonso. And by 1920, the blackware that I showed you was most in demand. By the middle 1920s, Maria Martinez became very famous, and they started selling their own work, and this revolutionized the economy of San Alfonso. It played havoc with it. Because what happened is, prior to this, people did not sign their pots, and husbands and wives and males and females worked together. The white patrons gave Maria and Julian the idea of selling their pots separately and signing them. And it was usually the women who were the ceramic artists, and the men did some of the painting. Right? The women were the ones who got the money. And what happened is it completely threw asunder the entire economic stability of San Ildefonso Pueblo. Because the women then had more power than the men, and this was a patriarchal society. So you have all these. Yeah?
Would that be an example of contact zone also?
Yeah, exactly. That's why I'm doing so. I started with the Central Desert in Australia and then switched.
Even though it's not commissioned, it's still just the idea of the collision.
Right, it doesn't have to be committed. The art that is produced is a result of the contact of the two cultures. And it wouldn't have happened without that contact, we think. You don't know, but we think. The other thing that's very interesting, if some of you know about strip mining, is this is Black Mesa, the famous Black Mesa, where the infamous Black Mesa of strip mining, and guess what? It is right next door to San Ildefonso Pueblo. So here's a view of San Ildefonso Pueblo from Black Mesa. The other thing that's very interesting about this area of our country is the complete acceptance of two religions at once. And again, this is not a Native American art class. So I'm not going to go into the whole history of it. But here you have the Catholic Church, photographed in 1977, but it's been there since about 1915. We have a small Catholic church in San Ildefonso, and here you have Maria's house right next to Akiva. So, 1910, at the Palace of the Governors in Santa Fe, selling her pottery. And she was very well known in 1910. I mean, her pottery was always in demand. Here she is with her sisters and sister-in-law. So you see it's a woman's task, right? It's the women who are making the pots in public, the women who are working the pots. Also, at this point, this is Maria and Julian who are sitting in public, and you see that Julian is decorating the pot that she made. So they started to collaborate in public. And here you have them together beginning to work on this very famous black tradition. By about 1912, Maria and Julian began to produce polished black pots. And they caught on like wildfire. Do I have a ceramicist in the room? Oh, good. I'm going to read what they did, and then you can tell the class how it works, okay? You smother the fire with damp manure, and you surround the pottery with sheets of metal in order to reduce the oxygen level. The clay, because of the reduced oxygen level, then turns black, because a dense smoke is created, which impregnates the clay with carbon. You sort of get it? Okay? This was done by experimentation. So Julian and Maria wanted to be different than the other potters, because there was this tradition, this pressure pots, et cetera, et cetera. So they were experimenting, and they produced this famous kind of pot that I showed you in the magazine cover. By 1917, there was an added boost to the tourist market when two women started a ranch and an endowment for the artists at San Ildefonso. So two outside women, white women, built a ranch, had a home there, and started an endowment. And the Martinez's worked on further perfecting their blackware. And then the other thing that Julian did is, Julian, it's a watercolor. It's very different than the watercolors I showed you before. He was working for an anthropologist to make extra money, and the anthropologist was digging up shards in the area around San Ildefonso, and Julian noticed that there was a decorative patterning, a painted patterning on the shards, and he brought them home, and he recreated, in a sense, a very older style of pottery that, so this is a water jar from 1910, but the kind of motif you see on it was recreated. It would have been shards or a museum piece, right, from an era that was pre-colonial, and this is Julian in 1925. And this is a blackware pot by Maria in 1939. So here we have two different styles of pottery that are considered traditional Southwest Native American pottery. And, they are not traditional. They are invented forms. So there's a wonderful book that has taught me a lot over the years. Those people who are, I don't know if any of you are in my Caribbean class, it's a book called The Invention of Tradition. It's a very scholarly book, but I had to read it in graduate school. And I just think of these words. I think it's so important to understand this. The invention of tradition. That's what we're looking at here. People will say that this pottery, traditional, famous Native American, but it was invented because of this contact zone, right? Because of what happened. And so this is the 1930s. Here's a postcard. Here's an advertisement for Maria and Julian Martinez in the 1930s. Yeah.
What was their relationship?
Oh, husband and wife. I'm so sorry. I never said it.
Couple.
Okay, husband and wife.
She did the designs as well, right? Or did it just you?
Julian did the painted designs. She and Julian work together on the blackware, but she's the potter, so to speak. That's the tradition of the Southwest. Yes?
How do you spell it, Kiva?
K-I-V-A. Thank you. This is 1950. They had a daughter named Santana, and this is designed by their daughter. So I just want to show you. This is Julian, one of Julian's paintings. And in a Native American art class, I spend much more time showing what he picked up from archaeology. But these intertwined serpents and this form here are things that were found in mural traditions, from pre-colonial mural traditions. He was working with anthropologists, okay? So I just want you to just sort of be familiar with this. And then we're going to go to this, the last thing today. Do you recognize at least one of the people in this particular little photograph? I hope so. Eleanor Roosevelt, right? She is standing with Fred Cabote. I taught you Fred Cabote in the watercolor. color selection right. This is Fred Cabote. This is Eleanor Roosevelt. This is the opening of a hugely important exhibition at the Museum of Modern Art in New York City called American Indian Art. And it opened in the year 1941. This was sort of the climax, because I remember I said that in the 30s, Mabel Dodge Leland had brought watercolors to the cultural head of Museum of Modern Art, very, very interested in art from around the world, put together this incredible exhibition in 1941. And Fred Cabote was hired to reproduce one of these free colonial murals from a Kiva mural that they had on the wall. They didn't reproduce the Kiva, they didn't pretend to, you know, to make it a religious event. But I want to show you what else happened, because this has so much importance for Jackson Pollock. Okay? So here we're in 1941 at the opening. They had Navajo sand paint, they're called sand painters, doing ground paintings at the opening. It takes us way back to the Midway, doesn't it? Right? I mean, museums do this all the time. So here, look at the way these women are dressed. Just every time I look at this photograph, I sort of giggle to myself, as if art openings could be so luxurious today. But here you have, here you have Navajo artists doing a ground drawing for the public to see, and it was done over the course of a few days at the opening of this exhibit in 1941. And I want to show you the way the exhibit was installed, because this is also important for all the white artists that you learned about in the course, you know, American Art 1940 to the present, right? This is the Museum of Modern Art. It's not a natural history museum. It's not an ethnographic museum. So they install the white cube. There's no, it's like those watercolors I started with. There's no atmosphere, right? There's very, very little didactics. Look at the wall. There's nothing written on the wall. This is art for art's sake. You have just discrete masks on white pillars, no writing anywhere. This is the southwest section. I know because I recognize it. But if you get no information, this is what we call the white cube aesthetic. And it's like the watercolors I showed you. It's discrete objects to be appreciated for themselves only. So this is the southwest section. This is the pottery of the southwest section, and Nimbres pottery. So you do see it's called Nimbres, but again, it's set up. You see each pot has its own white pedestal, you know, with a plexiglass plate. I couldn't resist to just show you what Nimbres pottery looks like close up. So again, it's an archaeological pottery tradition from the Nimbres Valley of Arizona. And these pots were put in graves and covered the head of the dead person in the grave. Most of them have been grave robbed. And now we're all in the city. In other words, how this all influenced the artists in New York City. So this is the, and that's it. So, yes?
Could you tell what the Nimbres?
Nimbres. Nimbres. It's the pottery style. The Nimbres Valley, named after where it was found. Question.
What was the name of this? The show again?
Indian Art of the United States, 1941, Museum of Modern Art, New York City. Very, very important. Could you just be quiet a second? Yes.
How do you spell San Ildefonso?
Right. S-A-N, right? I-L-D-E-F-O-N-S-O.
Okay. I capitalized the letter.
No.
Okay.
Just it's all the names of the pueblos are Spanish names, because the first people there were the Spanish. sets you off then for Tuesday's lecture on the New York Hip